Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, while the new Congress struggles with Iraq, how did an earlier Congress deal with the unpopular war in Vietnam? But let's start today with the first lawsuit in the nation accusing a tobacco company of handing out free cigarettes to minority children in the 1950s. That lawsuit is going to have its day in court. A Massachusetts judge has cleared the way for the lawsuit to go to trial. Will Evans of Boston is suing Lorillard Tobacco Company of North Carolina. Evans claims the company handed out free cigarettes to his mother, Marie, when she was a child, and that started a lifelong addiction. Marie Evans died of lung cancer in 2002 at the age of 54. Scott Allen is a Boston Globe health reporter. He's been covering this case. And Scott, first of all, how precedent-setting is this?
Well, as you know, there have been hundreds of lawsuits filed against cigarette makers, but so far as we know, there's never been one that went after their practice of handing out free cigarettes back in the 50s and perhaps into the early 60s. It was legal to give these things to adults, but it was illegal even at the time to hand out free cigarettes to children. And so this brings up a very novel area of cigarette company practices back in the 50s and 60s.
Let's look at what Will Evans is claiming. He says his mother lived in Roxbury, that's a mainly African-American neighborhood, in a housing project in Roxbury. What does he say happened?
She actually speaks in her own words because she spoke to lawyers and did depositions prior to her death in 2002. She said the Newport van would drive up to the edge of this playground near the Orchard Park housing project, and they would hand out these small sample packs of cigarettes that had 4 to 10 Newport cigarettes in them, and children all over the place were getting them, and she at first traded them for candy, but then she started smoking and had no idea of the danger and became addicted before she knew it.
She started at the age of 13, she says?
Correct.
So what is Lorillard Tobacco saying about the charge that they handed out these cigarettes?
Well, their blanket defense, and it's the defense tobacco companies use every time, is that anything bad that happened after 1969, they cannot be held liable for because they always put warning labels on the cigarette packs. And their argument about the free cigarette handout that happened way back in 56, 57 is even at that time, it was general knowledge that cigarettes were hazardous, and they were handing out cigarettes, but they were intended for adults. They just happened to be on the edge of a playground.
Well, let's address a couple things. It was the 1964 Surgeon General report that linked smoking to cancer that led to the writing on the packages, but that was after the handout that Marie says she got in the 50s.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we're talking about a small child in a minority community with not many resources, and she was addicted before there was a warning label, and she never could break it. In fact, her family says that she didn't fully understand the danger of cigarettes until she had her first heart attack in 1994.
Now, you interviewed former advertising executives for the tobacco industry in general. What did they say about these cigarette giveaways to children?
They said that it was not authorized, at least the people I spoke to. Norman Black, who was the creative director for Newport Cigarettes, it wasn't authorized to give it to kids, but there was no doubt they were targeting young people. There's no doubt they wanted African-American smokers, and Newport was really introduced as a brand for blacks. The mentholated filter cigarettes would really appeal to African-Americans.
And it wasn't just that. It was the packaging, too, that Marie said she was attracted to as a child.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, magazines like Ebony and Jet portrayed attractive, beautiful young black people. She thought that was glamorous. The cigarette pack was sort of a blue and white, very stylish-looking package, and she got about 50 free packages from the people that drove up to the playground.
Well, now you're saying that the ad executives said it wasn't authorized by the companies. Could the companies make that claim that, you know, they didn't know the ad executives, the ad companies were doing this, the marketing campaign was doing this?
You know, they could make that claim, but, you know, the fact of it is the tobacco companies have a terrible history of not telling the truth, and at this point, Lorillard itself is not commenting to the press on what's happening to them in this particular case, and we really haven't gotten to the merits of it yet. Mm-hmm. All I know is what they've filed in court papers, that they did do giveaways for adults, but not for children.
Well, minorities have long complained that the tobacco and liquor industries target their communities, that white suburbs would never tolerate these handouts or the billboards, and that the companies wouldn't dare. What else do you think this trial might open up, Scott?
Well, I think this does open up a terrible chapter where cigarette companies were certainly preying on very poor people that had limited information, and if it shows they were preying on minority children to get them to become lifelong smokers, it opens up a very serious and very sensitive part of American life.
Scott Allen, Boston Globe health reporter, speaking about a landmark court case, a trial that's now been allowed by a Massachusetts judge in which the tobacco industry is accused of handing out cigarettes to minority children. Scott, thanks so much for speaking with us, and we'll check back in with you as this goes on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today, U.S. senators who back a resolution against the troop surge in Iraq are threatening to attach their resolution to any bill that reaches the floor of the Senate if debate and a vote continue to be blocked. Meanwhile, House Democratic leaders are trying to come up with their own non-binding resolution against the president's decision to send an additional 21,000 troops and $1.2 billion to Iraq, and they're planning 3 days of debate next week. Well, critics say, what's the holdup? And others are wondering, what can Congress do about an unpopular war? We want to spend some time on that topic today with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University. He says Congress should look to recent history when another Congress regained the purse strings in an increasingly unpopular war, and that was in Vietnam. Julian writes about the Vietnam-era Congress in the upcoming March issue of The American Prospect. It's online right now, and he is right now in the studio with us with more. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's make your case, because a vague memory might be. People might be scratching their heads thinking, well, I thought Congress let that war grow from the early 60s to the 70s. So let's start with that perception that Congress, Republicans and Democrats, let Johnson and Nixon in particular dig deeper into American coffers and into the jungles of Vietnam.
Look, clearly Congress was guilty at many moments of rolling over to both administrations. But when I looked back, I found a lot of evidence at different moments when Congress really did stand up to the president and said, this is a bad idea or this is wrong. And they did it in different ways. But Congress was not always in agreement with this war.
Well, in fact, they did it very privately, which might have been why we didn't have that public perception. President Johnson, for instance, clearly struggling with Vietnam. This is in the mid-60s. You write about some of the phone conversations he had with members of Congress that are now available. Let's listen to one of them. This is June 1965. He's speaking to Senate Majority Leader Montana Democrat Mike Mansfield. This is right before Johnson truly escalated the war. Now, listen closely because it's not a great recording.
To me, it's shaping up like this, Mike. You either get out or you get in. I think you've done nearly everything that you can do, except make it a complete white man's war. And if you do that, then you might as well say goodbye all of Asia and to most of the world. Well, I think that's right. Therefore, where do you go?
You say goodbye to all of Asia and all of the world. Now, as we said, Johnson, answered his question, where do we go, by escalating the war. But there were other conversations. You write about Senator Richard Russell of Georgia. Tell us about that conversation.
Yeah, right up through the actual escalation of troops, many senators are privately saying, don't do this. Russell is a conservative Democrat, an anti-civil rights Democrat, a hawk, and a key power. And he is telling the president in private conversations, this is an unnecessary war. It has nothing to do with the Cold War, and we're not going to be able to get out. He sounds like the college students that we hear later in the 60s. And he's warning the president not to take this step.
And yet, what were these most of these people saying publicly?
Well, not everyone was supporting it. Actually, before 1965, some people like Senator Church were publicly saying, don't get into the war. Others were remaining silent. But it really takes a lot of prodding by the administration to get these senators to go along.
And in fact, they went quite a bit along during the Gulf of Tonkin resolution voting, August 64. This gave the president sweeping authority to use military force in Vietnam. You write, what was the vote? 416-0?
Yeah. And in the Senate, there's only 2 dissenters.
And you call that a missed opportunity. And certainly Congress was criticized for that. And we should say that in some ways, like the weapons of mass destruction that launched the war in Iraq, the Gulf of Tonkin was then discredited.
And what's more frustrating historically is many senators weren't happy with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. They were actually persuaded by Senator Fulbright, William Fulbright of Arkansas, to go along with the president. He assured them, A, this would protect Johnson in the 1964 election from the hawks, and B, he wouldn't use his authority, in the fullest extent. And Fulbright, who was a respected senator, and he believed this. He promised them. He gave them their word that Johnson was going to be cautious with this power.
Of course, and then he did indeed escalate. Well, then Fulbright was also pivotal in a turning point in Congress. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the next big turning point is in 1966. Fulbright is frustrated with the administration. He believes he's been betrayed, and he holds these hearings in February, televised hearings where he drags members of the administration in front of the cameras, and he asks them very tough, difficult questions about the war, not just the strategy, but the war itself. And that's a real turning point where many Americans start to raise questions about the war. He wasn't a college student either. He was a respected senior Southerner.
Well, in fact, let's talk a little bit about how Americans came to hear those hearings, because that's a fascinating parallel story. That it was it Fred Friendly, the
yes.
head of CBS, who wanted to televise these hearings. They bumped Captain Kangaroo, which was a big deal
yes.
at the time. And then, though, there was White House pressure not to televise them when the impact was seen.
Yeah, the two sources of pressure were the executives who didn't want to lose the revenue from the Captain Kangaroos and I Love Lucy's that were played during the time of the hearings. And the president directly calls CBS and says, take these off, because his people are telling him these hearings are damaging, that they're going around the country and they're starting to hear things about the war because of the hearings that they don't want to hear.
Right.
And so there was a lot of pressure. They're ultimately taken off, but the damage is done because enough goes on the air that Americans start to hear the concerns.
And this leads to the guns and butter debate. Tell us about this.
That takes place in 67 and 68. The pressure comes from the right, not the left. Moderates and conservatives in the Democratic Party, like Wilbur Mills of Arkansas, tell the president, look, if you're going to finance the war in Vietnam, if you're going to raise taxes to do it, you're going to have to cut the Great Society. And the battle,
the Great Society being Lyndon Johnson's grand plan.
War on poverty, right. All the domestic programs he loved so much. Johnson believed you could have guns and butter. And after 68, many liberals don't believe that anymore because they're forced to accept cuts in domestic programs that make them realize the budgetary cost of this war.
Let's take 1 second. We're going to take a break in about a minute. But this is where people might be sitting back and thinking, hey, actually, yeah, there has been no vociferous debate about cutting spending to pay for the war.
Yeah, one of the most important things right now is there has not been much dissent within the Republican Party. Much of the opposition in the 60s came from Democrats. Democrats were willing to attack each other. Until recently, Republicans have been much more unified and loyal to their party and to their president.
So let's jump back into present day. Given that, and would you say that, you know, I want you to complete the thought, that guns and butter debate did start to lead back to Congress controlling the purse strings on the war? What is, you know, some might say, given the midterm elections and the mandate the current Congress was given, what's holding up that debate today?
Well, I think there's still a lot of political fear about what will take place in 2008 if Republicans break from their own leaders. But I think the debate actually will happen. I think it's slow, but it's coming.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University. He's currently writing a history of national security politics since World War II. And his article on just what we've been talking about, the Vietnam-era Congress, appears in the March issue of American Prospect. It's online right now, so you can check it out. We're going to take a quick break, as I said, but when we come back, well, we haven't even gotten to the Nixon administration and the power of the purse and how it affected that. And don't forget, later in the program, more about Iraq. But speaking of purse strings, where did all the money go? We'll talk about the current hearings asking that question. Julian Zelitzer, back after the break. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Boston University history professor Julian Zelitzer. He writes about Congress during the Vietnam era and how Congress helped end the war in Vietnam, even though, as we've been saying, made some might see many missteps in the escalation of the war. And he says there are lessons for today's Congress there. And Julian, we were talking about, we'd just gotten to the Johnson administration where he was, the Johnson administration where he was forced to raise taxes and cut some of his domestic spending by Congress to pay for the escalation of the war. Bring us into the Nixon era. How did Congress use its power then?
Well, once a Republican was in the White House, Congress became much more assertive. They started to offer amendments between 1969 and 72, several Democrats, that would actually cut funding for different parts of the war, first in Thailand and Laos, then in Cambodia, and ultimately there were amendments to just cut spending in Southeast Asia altogether.
Did they force a policy shift?
They did. Oh, absolutely. If you read about the Nixon administration, Nixon felt the pressure coming from Congress. And many of the amendments were not full-scale budget cutoffs. They cut small parts of the war. But Nixon was sensing this was growing. The support was growing. And he was always under pressure to cut the troops, withdraw troops from Vietnam, and also to limit activities or to rely on secret activities, which proved very controversial.
Some of the secret activities, bombings in Cambodia, for instance, were separate from the troop withdrawal from Vietnam. At the time, you write, the anti-war contingent was crowing. Look, Nixon did what we said. Did he? Did he withdraw the troops?
Yeah, he did. Nixon's policy was called Vietnamization, and he gradually withdrew troops. Often the withdrawals were timed to major political protests or congressional debates, and he did gradually withdraw troops from Vietnam. What he didn't do was he continued secret bombing campaigns. But even there, Congress often asserted itself when these controversies flared.
Jumping into present time again, do you see a comparison between Nixon's Vietnamization, the idea that the South Vietnamese should take over their own fight, and what's happening today, this idea of it's sort of the reverse, because there is a proposal for, well, there is a troop surge, but it is, according to the White House, going to be attached to some sense of benchmark and withdrawal.
Yes. Nixon's idea to get out of this mess and to have political cover from Congress was to say, I am going to withdraw and we're going to give this over back to the South Vietnamese. And it was a way to say we are not just withdrawing, but we are going to have a better situation. Bush started by doing that, and he had a lot of opportunities. The big difference still, though, is he is calling for a surge in troops. Nixon did not do that. He went right for the withdrawals. And so there's a common aspect to this, but also a big difference, which I think is causing Bush some political problems right now.
Well, and we should say, you mentioned the secret bombings. Congress continued to use the power of the purse in 1970,
yep,
by prohibiting that.
Frank Church and John Sherman Cooper, a bipartisan team, passed an amendment after the revelation of that bombing that cut any more spending for operations in Cambodia, just as they had done the year before in other areas. And that was the first kind of real assertion of the power of the purse by Congress, saying there are certain things we're just not going to allow anymore.
How did Congress continue to assert that power? Let's say, take us up through Ford a little.
In 73, they'll cut funding for Southeast Asia as the whole thing is drawing down, though. The war's already coming to an end. In 75, they reject Congress's supplemental aid package for Vietnam from President Ford. They'll cut funding for operations in Angola in 1976. They'll pass back in 73 the War Powers Act, different than the budgetary power. But there's a lot of legislation, a lot of measures where a restless Congress is no longer as pliant as some thought it was.
So what has happened in your mind? I'm wondering, the numbers that are floating up in my head are 9/11. I'm just wondering, given that was Congress seeming to build momentum on this issue, what happened?
Yeah, look, 9/11, I think, is important. It was kind of a national shock that led to a lot of unity in both parties about going to war. Again, I think the partisan unity within each party, the parties are so undivided. They're so lockstep. The leadership is very powerful. It's hard for dissenters to do anything. The leaders use campaign money. They use rules to stifle dissent. And I think that's been an important part of the story. I think it's starting to crack now. But I think that's been extremely important. And third is public relations campaigns by supporters of the war were obviously effective. We're learning that in the Libby trial. This was an aggressively sold case about weapons of mass destruction. I think many people bought it.
Did that? Well, by the way, I'm rushing to say that there are a lot of people who will still say today that it was a mistake for Congress to cut off funds in Vietnam, that was the problem. And you're shaking your head no. I know historians largely disagree with that.
No, Vietnam was lost way before they did anything. Again, the biggest flaw of Congress is it didn't act fast enough, or even with all it did, it didn't do enough. But the war wasn't lost by the funding.
Did it do what it did, though, in the face of the same accusations that are thrown today? Back then, were those who were looking to cut funds for Vietnam also accused of not supporting the troops?
Yes. When Church and Cooper are floating their amendment on Cambodia in 1970, Nixon told Haldeman, his advisor, to get kind of loyal Republicans to, quote, attack Senate Doves for knife in the back disloyalty, lack of patriotism. And that's exactly what they started to charge. They argued that about McGovern, who had the most radical plan, just withdraw all the time.
Right. So what do you think is going to happen? Again, we know the Senate, well, according to the New York Times, they are tied up in procedural knots over these non-binding resolutions on the troop surge. House saying that they are going to really debate the war next week. The last I heard, allow members 5 minutes apiece to speak on it. In about the minute we have, what do you think is going to happen?
Look, there's two lessons from the Vietnam era. One is there's a lot Congress can do, and I think there's a lot they can do right now, and there's enough unrest within the party to suggest this debate will continue. On the other hand, the lesson is there's a lot of missed opportunities, and there is always that risk that Congress will do that now. But I think we're going to see more debate. I think public opposition can be very powerful in moving members of Congress.
Right, and so can upcoming elections,
exactly.
Perhaps. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, currently, as we said, writing a history of national security politics. His article on the Vietnam-era Congress is in the March issue of American Prospect. Also, you can find it at our website, here-now.org. It's online as well. And while you're there, by the way, a reminder, you can hear, if you missed any of this conversation, you can hear all of our programs anytime, download a podcast by also going to here-now.org. Julian, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Okay, quick note, tomorrow, a related topic in a way, living with traumatic brain injury from athletes to Iraq war vets. That's tomorrow. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Administration officials past and present are finding themselves in the hot seat more often in congressional hearings now that Democrats are in control. Taking their turns this morning were Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who testified before separate committees. Earlier this week, Paul Bremer faced tough questions about how he did in his job running Iraq in the early days after the invasion. California Congressman Henry Waxman grilled Bremer on nearly $9 billion that Waxman says have not been properly accounted for. Waxman's hearings came as President Bush is asking for another $1.2 billion to be spent on Iraq reconstruction. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Ranjiv Chandrasekharan, a national reporter for The Washington Post. He's also written the book Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Ranjiv, Congressman Waxman had a dramatic exchange with Paul Bremer about bundles of shrink-wrapped cash. What was said?
Well, Waxman, at the opening of the hearing, noted that the United States flew into Iraq in 2003 and 2004 about $12 billion in cash, much of it in $100 bills, shrink-wrapped on pallets flown in on military cargo aircraft. All told, Waxman calculated it was about 363 tons of U.S. cash. Now, this wasn't taxpayer money. This was actually money that was Iraqi money. It was the proceeds of the sale of Iraqi oil. But during the period of the American occupation, the United States was responsible for the disbursement of this money. And Waxman alleged that Ambassador Paul Bremer, the American administrator for the Coalition Provisional Authority, did not implement sufficient accounting practices and safeguards and other controls to ensure that this money wasn't going off to fraudulent purposes.
Well, in fact, you're couching it quite politely. What he said was, and as you write, who in their right mind would send 363 tons of cash into a war zone?
Indeed. He was quite flabbergasted that the United States would fly in all of this money. Now, Ambassador Bremer had a fairly direct response to that, and his response was that there was no functioning banking system in Iraq, and there were hundreds upon thousands of Iraqi government workers who needed to be paid their salaries or their pensions, and the only option was to pay them in cash, and as such, we had to bring in this money. That was Bremer's response to Waxman's allegation.
Well, and as you note, Republicans noted that the Inspector General also said that just because there was not enough oversight or accounting, it doesn't mean there was fraud.
Exactly. There was no smoking gun that showed that much of this money had been diverted to fraudulent or criminal purposes. At the same time, we know very well that there's been plenty of other fraud in Iraq and that a lot of money that is paid to Iraqi officials through the front door winds up going out the back door. And Waxman and the Democrats' contention was backed up by an inspector general, the special inspector general for Iraq's reconstruction, who turns out to be a Republican, to be a former friend of President Bush's from back in Texas, a fairly unlikely person to be an ally of the Democrats on this, but he wrote 2 years back a scathing audit of the way Bremer's organization handled this money and said that, you know,
what the CPA should have done was to have instituted some fairly modest accounting practices, not to set up, you know, modern American-style teams of auditors and accountants, but they could have at least asked for a little bit more from the Iraqis to have gotten at least a little bit more confidence that this money wasn't being funneled off to nefarious causes.
Well, we've already seen indictments against some Army Reserve officers, for instance, in an alleged bid rigging scam involving Iraqi reconstruction. We've already heard stories about, you know, Olympic-sized swimming pools that were requested by the Iraqi ministry, not authorized by the U.S., and are now sitting unused. But is there any proof that any of this money went to, for instance, insurgents or al-Qaeda?
There's no hard and fast proof. It's just that the Democrats feel that given the lack of proper accounting, there's a very high likelihood that some of this money went off through the back door and may have wound up in the hands of people who were fighting the United States.
Well, Paul Bremer in the hearings was also accused being somewhat cavalier about the money, because it wasn't U.S., as you said, U.S. tax dollar money. What was their proof that Bremer was cavalier?
Well, it was a fairly dramatic moment in the hearing. A Democratic Congresswoman, Diane Watson from California, read from a transcript of a speech that Bremer gave at Clark University in Massachusetts back in April 2005, where Bremer was quoted as saying to the audience, "I suggest you not worry, because the $9 billion is Iraqi money, not American money." Bremer, in response to that, insisted that he, quote-unquote, took seriously the responsibility to spend Iraq's money. But the Democrats had made their point.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who, by the way, has written about being in the Green Zone, I wonder your personal thoughts on this. We spoke to Rory Stewart, who also has written about working in Iraq and wrote about seeing these bundles of cash, wrote about seeing political appointees sort of running the show instead of people who knew about accounting. And this was another accusation that was made at the hearings. In your reporting in Iraq, did you see this kind of, you know, throwing around of this money that Rory saw?
Well, I certainly saw and wrote extensively about how people who were unqualified to make significant budgetary decisions and to make other high-level policy decisions were thrust into those roles. As I write in my book, you know, instead of sending the best and the brightest to govern and reconstruct Iraq in those crucial first months, in many cases, the Bush administration sent the loyal and the willing. People were chosen because of their political fidelity.
Well, and what are you hearing of the concerns going forward? The president wants to commit another $1.2 billion to Iraq reconstruction going forward. We're hearing that most of the companies working there now have to spend a huge percentage of money on security. So what are some of the concerns going forward?
The Democrats are concerned that better financial management standards are put in place, that projects are chosen that will have a maximum impact. And what the Democrats would like to see is more of this money going to Iraqi companies that will employ Iraqis and increase overall employment there. But the overall American spending in this current phase is a smaller part of the pie. The bigger chunk of money actually needs to be expended by the Iraqis. The Bush administration wants the government of Prime Minister al-Maliki to spend $10 billion of its own money on reconstruction. And interestingly enough, this is money that the Iraqis have in the bank. It's money from last year's Iraqi government budget that was unspent because Iraqi government ministries lack the capacity and lack the skills and lack the sort of wherewithal to be able to expend this money in a clear and transparent way.
Right. If they weren't able to do it last year, why would they be able to do it this year?
That's the big question.
Yeah. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, national reporter for The Washington Post. Rajiv, thanks as always.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, still to come before we go, actress Cherry Jones on taking the play Doubt on the road to cities that have seen real-life clergy sex abuse. You're listening to Here and Now. There are 20 million freelancers and independent contractors working in the U.S. today. They can be writers, plumbers, graphic artists, babysitters, consultants, you. But they all have one thing in common. Unless they make enough money to purchase private health care insurance, they have to pay out of pocket for medical services or go without. Sarah Horowitz is hoping to change that. A former labor lawyer and MacArthur Genius Award winner, Horowitz is founder of the Freelancers Union, which is offering members lower cost health coverage and other benefits. And she joins us now from New York City. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, tell me, let's say I'm a freelance writer and I want to join. How does that work?
It works a lot like the way the entertainment unions do. People just have to show that they work 20 hours a week in a bunch of different fields or earn a certain amount of money in the last 6 months. And then they can have health insurance that stays with them as they go from job to job and project to project.
Well, and we understand right now you sell these benefits a la carte, and people can pick and choose and put it together. And you use the purchasing power of the more people you have to get them a better deal.
Yeah, and really, that's the real point of this idea of a new unionism, is that here you have all these people, and they don't work for one employer for 25 years, and they're not in one building every single day, the same place all the time. And so what we've done is we've said, look, America has a new economy. People are moving around, they're mobile, they're flexible. Let's join together. Let's use technology that we have, bring them together, and start negotiating for the benefits that they need. Health insurance is obviously the top of the agenda, but it's the whole safety net. It's retirement, prescription, looking at the laws. For instance, freelancers work often on jobs that are 8-10 months long, and when they're done, they're not eligible for unemployment insurance, but they pay a ton of taxes, double portion for Social Security. And really, we have to start looking at how we're going to update the safety net for this new group of workers.
Well, the workers who are joining, many of them have said they are hoping that you will be, in addition to an organization that offers a group health plan, that you'll be advocates. Are you planning to push for legislation, for instance, the way other unions do? Can you do that if you have such a different group of people? They're so, you know, each one is so different.
We have to start talking about how it doesn't really matter whether you're an independent contractor or a regular employee. You should just be treated fairly. And benefits probably shouldn't just be located on the job. And so we can start talking about having benefits be surrounding the individual. And if you look at the initiatives in Massachusetts, for instance, for health, and in California, what I worry about is that we're going to end up as a society where individuals are just going to be getting health insurance from an insurance company as individuals. It's quintessential David and Goliath. And really, we have to be saying, look, if the employer is not going to be the main way that we're going to group people, what is? And the reason that you want that is because you do better in a group for negotiating. And also, you can really advocate for people. So a clear example, and we all either, this has either happened to us or we've known other people who this has happened to. Someone, let's say, gets diagnosed with something. And that's not the moment you want to be calling up a bureaucracy to negotiate why they denied your claim. But if you have an organization like ours, you can call us, and we have higher level relationships and can really make things work better.
Well, that does answer a question that's raised, because really you can't negotiate contracts. You can't have a shop steward. You can't negotiate pay rates and hours or working conditions, really, because, you know, there's potentially thousands of employers covering, you know, your workers who have thousands of different jobs. But you're saying that you will make a direct call.
And we do. But I think the major point is that every time you hear a debate, particularly in Washington, just close your eyes for a minute and you'll hear that what they're talking about are employers. They talk about large employers, small employers, but a third of the workforce is working independently. So what they're talking about is very typically irrelevant. And so that's why this part of the workforce is the group that really is pioneering the next safety net.
That's Sarah Horowitz. She's founder of the Freelancers Union, an effort to unionize in a new way freelancers across the country to offer them lower cost health coverage and other benefits. Sarah, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And for more on the Freelancers Union, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, after the break, Doubt, the play that leaves some doubt. Stay with us here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
What do you do when you're not sure? That's the topic of my sermon today. You look for God's direction and can't find it.
So begins John Patrick Shanley's drama, Doubt. It tells the story of Father Flynn, the priest of a parish and school in the Bronx, and Sister Aloysius, the school's principal, after she begins to suspect him of taking sexual advantage of one of the students in a time, 1964, when a nun wouldn't think of calling church leaders or the police. Doubt won the Pulitzer Prize in 2005 and won a Tony and rave reviews for Cherry Jones, who plays Sister Aloysius, the fiercely doctrinaire and often funny principal. Here she addresses a young nun on the pitfalls of Christmas characters.
Frosty the Snowman espouses a pagan belief in magic. The snowman comes to life when an enchanted hat is put on his head. If the music were more somber, people would realize the images are disturbing and the song heretical.
Doubt is now on a national tour, and in a rarity, the star, Cherry Jones, is going along with the play. It's in Boston this week and next, and Cherry Jones is in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
We just got a sense of, you know, a serious topic, but often hilarity ensues. I just want to ask right off the top, here we have a play about a priest suspected of sexual abuse of a child. Did you hear something or feel something from the audience here in Boston where the recent church scandal sort of began?
It's honestly hard to say.
It is.
All around the country, there's not a parish that hasn't been, there's certainly not an archdiocese that has not been touched by this issue. And if it's not about pedophilia within the church, then it's, you know, there are many audience members who were molested as children by family members.
Right.
Or, I mean, it's, but finally, it's not a play about child molestation or pedophilia. It is about the title. It is about Doubt.
That brings me to, you know, how you present this character. Do you think something happened?
Well, I'm a character in a parable. It is my job to, in broad strokes, with hopefully a fair amount of nuance, to present this absolutely, rigidly certain woman who is a vigilant shepherd of her flock, and she will go to her death to defend her children in this school. There are those who pass judgment on her, and I think they pass judgment on her unfairly by what they have seen. But the thing about this play is everyone walks in with their own baggage, and that's how they begin the process of deciding what happens in this play. And the action in the theater is not the four actors on stage playing out this parable. It's the action in the audience, and you feel it from the stage. It's electric because people in the audience first start off just doing battle with their own minds and hearts and souls and trying to process this information and how they feel about it. And they believe as they go along for the first 20 or 30 minutes of the play that everyone is having the exact same experience that they're having.
Right.
And then they start to hear audience responses that make them realize that no, other people, perhaps the person next to them, perhaps the person they've been married to for 40 years who is seated next to them, has the exact opposite opinion of what's going on.
Well, sure. I mean, in Boston, for instance, we had the real-life Father Paul Shanley, who was convicted, and he was also thought of as the hip priest, as the fictional priest in Doubt tries to present himself as the one who wants to bring, you know, the church to the people. And I felt it in the audience when he says in passing at one point, he tells your character, you know, I want to take the boys on camping trips, for instance. Did you hear that gasp from the audience?
Yeah, but as many people who gasped, there were people gasping that people had gasped.
Huh. Well, you were telling us about your character. Tell us more. Who is Sister Aloysius?
Shanley, our playwright, John Patrick Shanley, writes her as a widow. She was married. Her husband died in World War II. This is a woman who understands that to wipe the evil of Nazism off the face of the earth, Cologne, Dresden, Berlin had to be ground into dust. I mean, that's the world she understands.
How did you come to her? Because she's physically so different from you. Did you put something in your mouth to get that sort of speech that she had?
No, I wanted her to be affected by her life physically. I wanted you to You know, I just remember those old matrons in the 1960s, because I'm 50 years old and I was a child in the 60s, and I just remember those great old matrons who had shushy sounds because their dentures didn't quite fit right, and who had odd little idiosyncratic ways of speaking and moving, and I wondered why she hadn't had children, and so I decided at some point that she had had a hysterectomy as a young woman, and so now she's only in her early to mid-60s, but she looks much older because she has terrible osteoporosis. She has thin bones. And
none of this, I have to say to listeners, is spoken of. This is all
no,
in your head.
No, this is in my imagination. Yeah. I created it because I wanted her to have, I didn't want to have that sort of Pat Nunn ramrod posture, and I wanted her to show a hard life, and
pain,
she's bowed, and yet she's this sort of bowed monolith with this rather fragile shell, but with this will of iron. And her voice, I heard Mother Teresa interviewed once, and maybe she had laryngitis that day, but she sounded like this Albanian truck driver. She had this very coarse, crude voice. You know, you could see her just sort of bossing people around and rah, 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 this voice. But, you know, I imagine there were more saints who sounded like that than didn't, because it takes a lot of energy and a lot of telling people what to do. Anyway, the story itself is quite simple and very broad-strokey. So I wanted to just build in a few little idiosyncratic things that made that increased the contrast.
What happens when an actor is so wed to a role as you are now? Is it, you know, gosh, am I the luckiest person in the world? I'm sure there's so much of that there. But how much is there also of, wow, I'm really Sister Aloysius for a long time now, and what other ways does that affect you?
Well, I couldn't wait to go out on this tour. I knew that if I went out on tour, it had to be a play that could sustain itself. This play, as long as you can hear this play, you can get this play. It is so powerful and so engaging, and people leave this play and talk about it for the next 6 months. It does not leave you, this play.
Oh, no, but I'm wondering, does Sister Aloysius ever leave you, or do you ever want her to leave?
Well, no, I'm very pragmatic, and I knew exactly what I was signing up for. I had performed Aloysius 452 times in New York City before we ever headed out on tour, and by the time we end, I'll be a couple of scores shy of 700, maybe, mm-hmm. performances. But this kind of role is a great privilege because actors are used to doing plays that audiences like, but they become more engaged in the characters or how the actors play the characters. When you talk to people after this play, no one's talking about anything but the play itself.
Right.
And for an actor, that's a dream come true.
Someday, someone else is going to take over that role. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's going to happen very soon with the movie, and I don't know if it's actually been announced.
Wait a minute. You didn't get the part in the movie?
No, I'm not playing it in the movie.
How do you feel about that?
I feel, you know what? I will have done it 700 times, and I'm a stage actress. I play small parts in films, but I've never carried a film, and I have no box office. And again, I'm very pragmatic, and I happen to be a huge fan of the actress who is going to play Sister Aloysius. And I basically said to John Patrick Shanley, I want two tickets to the premiere. That's all I'm asking. And I think I've earned the right.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to have to hold you here. Who is it?
You could probably guess.
Oh, man. I tell you what, we're going to start doing that right now. We'll let listeners do that as well. But in the meantime, if you're happy about that, then we are too.
Well, thank you very much.
Jerry Jones, again, created Sister Aloysius and is appearing on stage. For more, go to our website. Jerry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm guessing Sally Field. I mean, you know, she was the Flying Nun. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Meantime, Terry Jones, I wish it was her. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public